While riding my bike through the streets of Beijing, I occasionally saw a black limo with tinted windows that belonged to one of the party bigwigs. Otherwise, there were few cars and no signs of a free market. I was amazed to see how a country with such a rich history could be so bleak. In 1975, China was emerging from the Cultural Revolution, its government's effort to purify and revitalize society. Communist officials had set up indoctrination programs, broadcast propaganda over omnipresent loudspeakers, and sought to stamp out any evidence of China's ancient history. Mobs of young people lashed out against their elders and attacked the intellectual elite. The society was divided against itself and cascading into anarchy. China's experience reminded me of the French and Russian revolutions. The pattern was the same. People seized control by promising to promote certain ideals. Once they had consolidated power, they abused it, casting aside their beliefs and brutalizing their fellow citizens. It was as if mankind had a sickness that it kept inflicting on itself. The sobering thought deepened my conviction that freedom, economic, political, and religious, is the only fair and productive way of governing a society. For most of my time at Harvard, I had no idea how I was going to use my business degree. I knew what I did not want to do. I had no desire to go to Wall Street. While I knew decent and admirable people who had worked on Wall Street, including my grandfather, Prescott Bush, I was suspicious of the financial industry. I used to tell friends that Wall Street is the kind of place where they will buy you or sell you, but they don't really give a hoot about you so long as they can make money off you. I was searching for options when my Harvard classmate, Del Marting, invited me to spend spring break of 1975 at his family's ranch in Tucson, Arizona. On the way out west, I decided to make a stop in Midland. I'd heard from my friend Jimmy Allison, who had become publisher of the Midland Reporter-Telegram, that the place was booming. He was right. The energy industry was on the upswing after the 1973 Arab oil embargo. The barriers to entry in the industry were low. I loved the idea of starting a business of my own. I made up my mind. I was headed back to Texas. I pulled into town in the fall of 1975 with all my possessions loaded into my 1970 Oldsmobile Cutlass. I had a lot to learn, so I sought out mentors. One of the first people I visited was a local lawyer named Boyd Laughlin, affectionately known as Loophole. He set up a meeting with Buzz Mills, a big man with a crew cut and years of experience in the oil business. I found Buzz and his partner, a cigar-chomping man named Ralph Way, playing gin rummy. I couldn't tell how much money they were betting on the game, but it was a hell of a lot more than I had. Behind their friendly country demeanor was a shrewd understanding of the oil business. I told Buzz and Ralph that I wanted to learn to be a landman. The job of a landman is to travel to county courthouses and research who owns the mineral rights to potential drilling sites. The keys to success in the job are a willingness to read lots of paperwork, a sharp eye for detail, and a reliable car. I started by tagging along with seasoned landmen, who showed me how to read title books. Then I made trips on my own, checking courthouse records for day fees. Eventually, I bought a few royalties and small working interests in Buzz and Ralph's wells. Compared to the big-time oil men, I was collecting the crumbs. But I was making a decent living and learning a lot. I held down costs by living lean. I rented a 500-square-foot alley house that friends described as a toxic waste dump. One corner of my bed was held together with a necktie. I didn't have a washing machine, so I took my laundry over to Don and Susie Evans' place. Susie and I had known each other since grade school. She married Don, a Houston native with 2 degrees from the University of Texas, and they moved to Midland to break into the oil business. Don was a down-to-earth, humble guy with a great sense of humor. We ran together, played golf, and forged a lifelong friendship. In the spring of 1976, Don and another close friend, a Midland orthopedic surgeon named Charlie Younger, suggested I join them for a Willie Nelson concert in Odessa. Of course, we needed a little libation to prepare for the event. We bought hip bottles of bourbon and had a few slugs on the way. When we got to the Ector County Coliseum, we were reminded that no drinking was allowed. We took a couple more gulps, discarded the bottles, and went to our seats. Charlie decided we needed more alcohol to enjoy the experience fully. To our amazement, he was able to convince a stagehand that Willie Nelson needed some beer. The guy dutifully went out and bought the beer with Charlie's money. Charlie left one case for Willie and snuck one back to us. We hunched over in our seats and drank like thirst-ravaged wanderers. After we had each downed several bottles, Charlie suggested we head up to the stage to thank his new friend. Don wisely stayed behind. Not me. Over the noise of the band, I heard people yelling my name. A group of Midlanders in the front of the crowd had recognized Charlie and me. They were shouting for beer. We accommodated them. When the concert ended, Charlie stuffed several long-neck bottles under his shirt. As the three of us were walking out, the long necks slipped and exploded on the floor, one after another. It was as if we had set off an alarm for the authorities. Our steady stride turned into a sprint for the exits. Three bozos running for our reputations. The next day, dozens of folks in Midland told me they had seen me on stage with Willie. There was no editorial commentary until one old boy said, "I look like a fool up there." He was right. I spent Labor Day weekend 1976 at our family's house in Kennebunkport, Maine. That Saturday night I was at a bar with my sister Doro, Dad's longtime political aide Pete Russell, and two family friends, Australian tennis star John Newcomb and his wife Angie. John introduced me to the Aussie tradition of drinking beer with no hands. You put your teeth on the edge of the mug and tilt your head back and the beer goes down your throat. We had a great old time, until the drive home. A local policeman, Calvin Bridges, thought it was odd that I was going about 10 miles an hour and had two wheels on the shoulder. When I failed the straight-line walk, he took me off to the station. I was guilty and told the authorities so. I was also embarrassed. I had made a serious mistake. I was fortunate I hadn't done any harm to my passengers, other drivers, or myself. I paid a $150 fine and did not drive in Maine for the prescribed period. The case was closed. Or so I thought. That fall, I started thinking seriously about settling down. The DUI was part of it. But the feeling had been building for months. My rootless ways were getting a little old. So was I. The big 3-0 had come in the summer. I had pledged that I would spend my first 10 years after college experiencing a lot and not getting tied down. That was a promise I'd kept. But the decade was almost up. Back home in Midland in July 1977, my old friend Joe O'Neill invited me over for a burger. I rarely turned down homemade meals. They sure beat the fast food that tended to be my staple. Joe and his wife Jan had someone they wanted me to meet. One of Jan's best friends, Laura Welch. I arrived a little late. There in the backyard were Jan and Laura, who was wearing a blue sundress. She was gorgeous. She had stunning blue eyes and moved so gracefully. She was intelligent and dignified, with a warm and easy laugh. If there is love at first sight, this was it. Laura and I discovered that we had grown up near each other in Midland, and both attended seventh grade at San Jacinto Junior High. We had even lived in the same apartment complex in Houston. She lived on the quiet side, where people sat by the pool and read books. I lived on the side where people played water volleyball till late at night. No wonder our paths had never crossed. I called Laura the next day, and we agreed to meet again that night. I asked if she wanted to play putt-putt golf. I knew she was my kind of girl when she agreed. Her short game was a little shaky, but she was a lot of fun to be around. My favorable impressions from the previous evening were strengthened. There was only one bad part. Laura had to go back to Austin, where she was a school librarian at Dawson Elementary. I missed her immediately, and started visiting her there as often as I could. We were a perfect match. I'm a talker. Laura is a listener. I am restless. She is calm. I can get a little carried away. She is practical and down to earth. Above all, she is genuine and natural. There is no phoniness about her. Her appeal was immediate and constant. In August, I went to visit my family in Kennebunkport, planning to stay for a week. After one night, I flew back to Texas to be with Laura. A few weeks after we met, Laura introduced me to her parents, Harold and Jenna Welch. Her mom, a kind, sweet, and patient woman, always made me feel welcome. Her dad loved sports and enjoyed putting down a wager or two on football. His hangout was Johnny's Barbecue. The locals called it the Sick Pig because of the awful wooden pig on top of the restaurant. One day, Laura's dad introduced me to his friends at the Sick Pig, including Johnny himself. I think I passed muster because I was offered a screwdriver. I turned it down. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. The courtship moved fast. One weekend, Laura and I took a trip to Ann and Tobin Armstrong's ranch in South Texas. Ann was a former U.S. ambassador to Great Britain, and she and Tobin had invited Prince Charles to play polo. Another weekend, we visited John and Angie Newcomb at his tennis academy in New Braunfels, in the beautiful Texas Hill Country. This time I kept my hands on the beer mug and off the steering wheel. I was falling hard for Laura. I was not much of a cat person, but I knew our relationship was solid when I bonded with her black and white short hair, Dewey, named for the decimal system. I've never been afraid to make a decision, and in late September I made a big one. One night in Laura's small Austin rental house, I said, "Let's get married." She said yes right away. Ours had been a whirlwind romance, but we were ready to commit. Soon after the engagement, Laura and I traveled to Houston, where Jeb and Columba were celebrating the christening of their daughter, Noelle. I introduced Laura to the family. They were as smitten with her as I had been. Laura knew she would be joining a large, competitive family, and that suited her just fine. As an only child, she got a kick out of the boisterous Bush clan. Our parents checked their schedules, and we picked the first Saturday available. November 5th, 1977. We had a small wedding with family and close friends in Midland. The invitations were handwritten by Laura's mom. We had no ushers, no bridesmaids, and no groomsmen. It was just me, Laura, and her dad to walk her down the aisle. While I couldn't pinpoint it at the time, I believe there is a reason Laura and I never met all those years before. God brought her into my life at just the right time, when I was ready to settle down and was open to having a partner at my side. Thankfully, I had the good sense to recognize it. It was the best decision of my life. Shortly after we got married, Laura and I decided to have children. After a couple of years of trying, it was not happening as easily as we had hoped. We discussed, reflected, prayed, and made the decision to adopt. At first, I was uneasy about parenting someone else's child. But the more I looked into adoption, the more comfortable I became. We had friends who had adopted and loved their children as a precious blessing. And we were fortunate to know about a wonderful agency called the Edna Gladney Home in Fort Worth. Founded by a Methodist missionary in 1887, Gladney had become one of the premier adoption homes in the world. Laura and I were introduced by phone to the longtime director, Ruby Lee Pister. She invited us to tour the hospital, where we met some of the pregnant women who were near term. I was touched by their selfless decision to bring their children into the world and give them to couples like us. The application process took several months. First, there was the initial interview, which included a lengthy questionnaire. Fortunately, we passed. In the next stage, Gladney planned to send a representative for a home visit. Laura and I were preparing meticulously. Then, in early 1981, she stunned me with the news that she thought she was pregnant. Some weeks later, we scheduled a trip to a sonogram expert in Houston, a lovely Indian-American woman named Srini Malini. I was nervous as she guided the device over Laura's body. She looked at the video monitor and said, "Here is the head, and here is the body. It's a girl." She moved to get a better angle. Suddenly she shouted, "I see two babies, two beautiful babies. This one is a girl as well. You are going to be the parents of twins." My eyes filled with tears. It was a double blessing. I started calling the sonogram image our first family photo. When we called the Gladney director to deliver the news, we felt strangely guilty, as if we had been leading her on. She told Laura something so sweet. "Honey, this happens sometimes. Gladney can help a couple have a child one way or another." Ruby Lee was more right than she knew. On the original questionnaire, Laura had checked the box saying, "We would prefer to adopt twins." The doctors had warned us that twins can be a high-risk pregnancy. Laura refused to decorate the nursery out of superstition. About 7 months into the pregnancy, Laura was diagnosed with preeclampsia, a serious condition that could damage her kidneys and jeopardize the health of the girls. The day after we received this news, Laura checked into Baylor Hospital in Dallas, where her uncle was a surgeon. The doctors told Laura that she should begin bed rest. I knew Laura had the best possible care, but I was worried. I remembered Mother's miscarriage. I had seen my parents after Robin died. I knew how much it hurt to lose a child. I confessed my anxiety to Laura. I'll never forget her reaction. She looked at me with her blue eyes and said, "George, I am going to bring these girls into the world. They will be born healthy." I marveled at my wife's strength. This quiet, unassuming woman was one tough soul. 2 weeks later, I was in my office in Midland. I'd been shuttling back and forth to Dallas when I got a call from Dr. James Boyd. He was in charge of Laura's care, and he was not big on chit-chat. "George," he said, "you are having your children tomorrow. I will deliver them at 6 a.m. I asked about Laura's health. He said she would be okay. "What about the girls?" He said, "They will be 5 weeks premature. They will be fine, but the time to move is now." I called Laura to tell her how thrilled I was. Then I called her parents in Midland, my parents in Washington, a bunch of our friends, and, of course, the airlines. I've been to some exciting events in my life. Presidential inaugurations, speeches in front of huge crowds, throwing out the first pitch at Yankee Stadium. But there was nothing like the moment those girls were born. Laura was in bed and sedated. I stroked her head. Before long, the doctor held up a tiny red body. The baby screamed, and the doctor proclaimed her healthy. The nurse cleaned her and gave her to me. Little Barbara. And then the same for Jenna. We wanted our girls to carry the names of two fine women, so we named them after our mothers. I had thought about those girls for so long that I could barely believe they were in my arms. It was the day before Thanksgiving, 1981. And thankful is exactly how I felt. I was thankful to God for their lives, thankful to the skilled medical team for their excellent care, and thankful to Laura for her determination to carry our girls long enough that they could be born healthy. Holding Barbara and Jenna for the first time was a moment of incredible clarity. I had been given a blessing and a responsibility. I vowed to be the best father I could possibly be. Those early months provided a wake-up call. The girls would cry in the middle of the night. I would pick them up, one in each arm, and walk around the house. I wanted to sing them a lullaby, but I didn't really know any. Instead, I usually went with the Yale fight song. "Bulldog, bulldog, bow, wow, wow." That would calm them down. Maybe just because they didn't want to hear me sing anymore. Whatever the reason, it worked. I would lay them in their cribs and go back to Laura as one happy dad. As Laura and I were adjusting to life with our new family, I was running a new business. In 1979, I started a small energy exploration company in Midland. I raised money mostly from the East Coast to finance drilling in low-risk, low-return oil and gas wells. I made some respectable finds, including some that is still producing. I also drilled my fair share of dry holes. Running a small business taught me a lot, especially that market conditions can change quickly, so you'd better be prepared for the unexpected. As oil prices softened in 1983, I decided to merge my operations with two entrepreneurs from Cincinnati, Bill DeWitt and Mercer Reynolds. I would be the eyes and ears on the ground in Texas, and they would raise funds back east. The business did well for a couple of years, and we became close friends. But in early 1986, the price of oil plummeted from $26 to $10 a barrel. A lot of people I knew had borrowed heavily and were now in dire financial jeopardy. Fortunately, we had kept our debt low, and we were able to merge our business into a larger, publicly traded company, Harkin Energy. The mid-1980s were gloomy years in Midland. There was a sense of anxiety, and many were searching for purpose. Religion had always been part of my life, but I really wasn't a believer. I was baptized in Yale's non-denominational Dwight Hall Chapel. When I was young, my parents took me to First Presbyterian in Midland, St. Martin's Episcopal in Houston, and St. Anne's Episcopal in Kennebunkport. I went to church at Andover because it was mandatory. I never went at Yale. I did go when I visited my parents, but my primary mission was to avoid irritating Mother. Laura and I were married at First United Methodist in Midland. We started going regularly after the girls were born because we felt a responsibility to expose them to faith. I liked spending time with friends in the congregation. I enjoyed the opportunity for reflection. Once in a while, I heard a sermon that inspired me. I read the Bible occasionally and saw it as a kind of self-improvement course. I knew I could use some self-improvement. But for the most part, religion was more of a tradition than a spiritual experience. I was listening, but not hearing. In the summer of 1985, we took our annual trip to Maine. Mother and Dad had invited the great evangelical preacher Billy Graham. Dad had asked him to answer some questions from the family after dinner. That was typical of Dad, always willing to share. It would have sent a signal of importance to have had Billy to himself, but that is not George H.W. Bush. He is a generous man, devoid of a big ego. So there we sat, about 30 of us. Laura, my grandmother, brothers and sister, first and second cousins, in the large room at the end of the house on Walker's Point. The first question was from Dad. He said, "Billy, some people say you have to have a born-again experience to go to heaven. Mother, my grandmother, here is the most religious kind person I know, yet she has had no born-again experience. Will she go to heaven?" Wow, pretty profound question from the old man. We all looked at Billy. In his quiet, strong voice, he replied, "George, some of us require a born-again experience to understand God, and some of us are born Christians. It sounds as if your mom was just born a Christian." I was captivated by Billy. He had a powerful presence, full of kindness and grace and a keen mind. The next day, he asked me to go for a walk around the property. He asked about my life in Texas. I talked to him about the girls and shared my thought that reading the Bible could make me a better person. In his gentle, loving way, Billy began to deepen my shallow understanding of faith. "There's nothing wrong with using the Bible as a guide to self-improvement," he said. "Jesus' life provides a powerful example for our own. But self-improvement is not really the point of the Bible. The center of Christianity is not the self. It is Christ." Billy explained that we are all sinners, and that we cannot earn God's love through good deeds. He made clear that the path to salvation is through the grace of God, and the way to find that grace is to embrace Christ as the risen Lord, the Son of a God so powerful and loving that He gave His only Son to conquer death and defeat sin. These were profound concepts, and I did not fully grasp them that day. But Billy had planted a seed. His thoughtful explanation had made the soil less firm and the brambles less thick. Shortly after we got back to Texas, a package from Billy arrived. It was a copy of The Living Bible. He had inscribed, "To my friend George W. Bush, may God bless you and Laura always." He included a reference to Philippians 1:6, "And I am certain that God, who began the good work within you, will continue His work until it is finally finished on the day when Christ Jesus returns." In the early fall, I mentioned my conversation with Billy to Don Evans. He told me he and another Midland friend, Don Jones, had been attending a community Bible study. It met Wednesday nights at First Presbyterian Church. I decided to give it a shot. Each week we studied a chapter from the New Testament. At first I was a little skeptical. I had a hard time resisting the temptation to wisecrack. One night the group leader asked, "What is a prophet?" I answered, "That's when revenue exceeds expenses. No one has seen one around here since Elijah." Soon I started to take the sessions more seriously. As I read the Bible, I was moved by the stories of Jesus' kindness to suffering strangers, His healing of the blind and crippled, and His ultimate act of sacrificial love when He was nailed to the cross. For Christmas that year, Don Evans gave me a daily Bible, a version split into 365 individual readings. I read it every morning and prayed to understand it more clearly. In time, my faith began to grow. At first I was troubled by my doubts. The notion of a living God was a big leap, especially for someone with a logical mind like mine. Surrendering yourself to an Almighty is a challenge to the ego, but I came to realize that struggles and doubts are natural parts of faith. If you haven't doubted, you probably haven't thought very hard about what you believe. Ultimately, faith is a walk, a journey toward greater understanding. It is not possible to prove God's existence, but that cannot be the standard for belief. After all, it is equally impossible to prove He doesn't exist. In the end, whether you believe or don't believe, your position is based on faith. That realization freed me to recognize signs of God's presence. I saw the beauty of nature, the wonder of my little girls, the abiding love of Laura and my parents, and the freedom that comes with forgiveness, all what the preacher Timothy Keller calls clues of God. I moved ahead more confidently on my walk. Prayer was the nourishment that sustained me. As I deepened my understanding of Christ, I came closer to my original goal of being a better person, not because I was racking up points on the positive side of the heavenly ledger, but because I was moved by God's love. I realized something else. When Billy started answering questions that night in Maine, I was on my third glass of wine, after a couple of beers before dinner. Billy's message had overpowered the booze, but that was not always the case. I had long been a social drinker. I liked to drink with friends, with meals, at sporting events and at parties. By my mid-30s, I was drinking routinely, with an occasional bender thrown in. We had a saying in West Texas. Last night he thought he was a 10, when in fact he was an ass. That applied to me more than once. I like to joke around, but alcohol has a way of turning a quip or tease into a slash or insult. What seems funny with booze can sound so stupid later. One summer night we were having dinner in Maine after a great day of fishing and golf. I had worked up a thirst, which I quenched with multiple bourbon and sevens. As we were eating, I turned to a beautiful friend of mother and dad's and asked a boozy question. "So, What is sex like after 50? Everyone at the table looked silently at their food, except for my parents and Laura, who glared at me with disbelief. The lovely woman let out a nervous laugh, and the conversation moved on. When I woke up the next day, I was reminded of what I had said. I instantly felt that morning after remorse. After I called the woman to apologize, I started asking myself if this was really the way I wanted to lead my life. Years later, when I turned 50, the good-natured woman sent a note to the Texas governor's mansion. "Well, George, how is it?" Laura saw a pattern developing, too. What seemed hilarious or clever to my friends and me was repetitive and childish to her. She wasn't afraid to tell me what she thought, but she couldn't quit for me. I had to do that on my own. At age 40, I finally found the strength to do it, a strength that came from love I had felt from my earliest days, and from faith that I didn't fully discover for many years. I haven't had a drop of alcohol since that night at the Broadmoor in 1986. There's no way to know where my life would have headed if I hadn't made the decision to quit drinking. But I am certain that I would not be recording these thoughts as a former governor of Texas and president of the United States. I've been asked if I consider myself an alcoholic. I can't say for sure. I do know that I have a habitual personality. I was drinking too much, and it was starting to create problems. My ability to quit cold leads me to believe that I didn't have a chemical addiction. Some drinkers are not as fortunate as I was. I admire those who use other methods to quit, such as the 12-step process of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not have quit drinking without faith. I also don't think my faith would be as strong if I hadn't quit drinking. I believe God helped open my eyes, which were closing because of booze. For that reason, I've always felt a special connection to the words of Amazing Grace, my favorite hymn. I once was lost, but now am found. Was blind, but now I see. Chapter 2. Running. The morning of June 12, 1999 was beautiful in Texas. The Rangers were in first place in the American League West. The Dow Jones Industrial Average stood at 10,490. Dad had just celebrated his 75th birthday by parachuting out of an airplane, successfully. And I was about to make a leap of my own. After months of soul-searching and countless hours weighing the pros and cons, I was headed to Iowa, site of the first caucus in the 2000 presidential election. I was free from the anxiety of making the decision and eager to begin the journey. Laura and I kissed the girls goodbye, headed to the airport, and boarded a TWA charter bound for Cedar Rapids. The flight was packed, mostly with journalists. They had filled hours of television and reams of newsprint, debating, questioning, and analyzing whether I would run. Now they were going to get the answer. I decided to have a little fun with them. I'd christened our plane Great Expectations. Shortly after we lifted off, I grabbed the microphone and announced, "This is your candidate. Please stow your expectations securely in the overhead bins, as they may shift during the trip and may fall and hurt someone, especially me." I often use humor to diffuse tension, but I knew I was embarking on a serious undertaking. More than almost any other candidate in history, I understood what running for president would entail. I had watched Dad endure grueling months on the campaign trail under the constant scrutiny of a skeptical press. I had seen his record distorted, his character attacked, his appearance mocked. I had witnessed friends turn against him and aides abandon him. I knew how hard it was to win, and I knew how much it hurt to lose. I worried most about our 17-year-old daughters, Barbara and Jenna. I had learned that being a child of a politician is tougher than being a politician yourself. I understood the pain and frustration that comes with hearing your dad call nasty names. I knew how it felt to worry every time you turned on the TV. and I knew what it was like to live with the thought that any innocent slip could embarrass the President of the United States. I had gone through all of this in my 40s. If I became president, my girls would be in college when I took office. I could only imagine how much more difficult it would be for them. I had thought through some big questions. Was I willing to forgo my anonymity forever? Was it right to subject my family to the scrutiny of a national campaign? Could I handle the embarrassment of defeat with the whole country watching? Was I really up to the job? I believed I knew the answers, but there was no way to be sure. I did know that I felt a calling to run. I was concerned about the future of the country, and I had a clear vision of where to lead it. I wanted to cut taxes, raise standards in public schools, reform Social Security and Medicare, rally faith-based charities, and lift the sights of the American people by encouraging a new era of personal responsibility. As I said in my speeches, when I put my hand on the Bible, I will swear to not only uphold the laws of our land, I will swear to uphold the honor and dignity of the office to which I have been elected, so help me God. My exposure to the presidency had revealed the potential of the job. The two presidents I knew best, Dad and Ronald Reagan, had used their time in office to accomplish historic objectives. President Reagan had challenged the Soviet Union and helped win the Cold War. Dad had liberated Kuwait and guided Europe toward unity and peace. I had also seen the personal side of the presidency. For all the scrutiny and stress, Dad loved the job. He left office with his honor and values intact. Despite the many pressures, the intensity of the experience brought our family closer together. The decision process was all-consuming. I thought about it, talked about it, analyzed it, and prayed about it. I had a philosophy I wanted to advance, and I was convinced I could build a team worthy of the presidency. I had the financial security to provide for my family, win or lose. Ultimately, the decisive factors were less tangible. I felt a drive to do more with my life, to push my potential and test my skills at the highest level. I had been inspired by the example of service my father and grandfather had set. I had watched Dad climb into the biggest arena and succeed. I wanted to find out if I had what it took to join him. Even if I lost, I would still have a wonderful life. My family loved me, I would be governor of a great state, and I would never have to wonder what might have been. When my time is up, I would tell friends, my dance card is going to be full. My announcement came at a barbecue in the small Iowa town of Amana. I gave my speech in a barn, atop a stage covered with hay in front of a giant cornfield. Congressman Jim Nussel, who would later serve as my Office of Management and Budget Director, introduced me by singing Iowa Stubborn from The Music Man. With Laura at my side, I said, I'm running for President of the United States. There's no turning back, and I intend to be the next president. My path to that day was unconventional. I hadn't spent a lifetime planning to run for president. If I had, I probably would have done a few things differently when I was younger. Yet along the journey, I built up the desire and skills to wage and win a presidential campaign. The seeds of that decision, like many others in my life, were planted in the dusty ground beneath the boundless sky of Midland, Texas. Politics in Midland were conservative. West Texas has an independent spirit and distrust of centralized government. Like much of Texas, Midland had been dominated by the Democratic Party for generations. Midland's sprawling congressional district, which included 17 counties, had been represented by a Democrat named George Mann for 43 years. He was the longest-serving congressman in America. On July 6, 1977, my 31st birthday, he announced that he would retire at the end of his term. By then, I had been back in Midland for 2 years after business school. I was learning the oil business, reconnecting with friends, and generally enjoying life. I was also getting a feel for the political scene. While I had never considered politics as a profession, I had helped out in all of Dad's campaigns, his Senate race in 1964, his House campaign in 1966, and his second bid for the Senate in 1970. Before I started flight training in 1968, I spent several months as a traveling aide to Congressman Edward Gurney, who was running for the Senate in Florida. The highlight of the experience was a huge rally in Jacksonville, where Gurney was endorsed by the tall, tan governor of California, Ronald Reagan. In 1972, I was the political director for Red Blunt's Senate campaign in Alabama. In 1976, I volunteered on President Ford's West Texas operation in the Republican primary. I helped him win a total of 0 delegates. The campaign lifestyle was a perfect fit for me in my 20s. I enjoyed moving around and meeting new people. I thrived on the intensity and competition of the races. I liked the finality that came on election day when the voters picked a winner and we all moved on. I hadn't planned it this way, but by the time Congressman Mann retired, I was a relatively seasoned political operative. I started to think about running for the seat. I had the experience to handle the political side of the race. I also felt something stronger pulling me in. I was concerned about the direction of the country. My experiences in business school, China, and the oil business were converging into a set of convictions. The free market provided the fairest way to allocate resources. Lower taxes rewarded hard work and encouraged risk-taking, which spurred job creation. Eliminating barriers to trade created new export markets for American producers and more choices for our consumers. Government should respect its constitutional limits and give people the freedom to live their lives. When I looked at Washington under President Jimmy Carter and the Democratic Congress, I saw the opposite. They had plans to raise taxes, tighten government control over the energy sector, and substitute federal spending for private sector job creation. I worried about America drifting left toward a version of welfare state Europe, where central government planning crowded out free enterprise. I wanted to do something about it. I was having my first experience with the political bug, and it was biting hard. When I told Mother and Dad about my idea, they were surprised. My decision must have seemed like it had come out of nowhere, but they didn't want to dampen my enthusiasm. Dad asked if I would be willing to listen to advice from a friend of his, former Texas Governor Alan Shivers. Absolutely, I said. Shivers was a legend. He had been the longest-serving governor in Texas history. He was a conservative Democrat, and his advice would be valuable in a race against Kent Hance, a right-of-center state senator and the likely Democratic nominee. When I went to see the old governor, he asked me point-blank if I was running for Mr. Mann's seat. I said I was seriously considering the race. He looked me in the eye and said, "Son, you can't win." There was no encouragement, no nothing. He told me that the district was drawn perfectly to elect Kent Hance. I mumbled something like, "I hope you were wrong if I decide to run," and thanked him for his time. I remember wondering why Dad had introduced me to the governor. Looking back on it, it may have been his way of telling me, without smothering my ambition, that I should be prepared to lose. The first phase of the campaign was the Republican primary. I made it into a runoff against Jim Reese, a smooth-talking former sportscaster and mayor of Odessa. He had run against George Mann in 1976 and felt entitled to the nomination in 1978. He was very unhappy that I had outpolled him in the first round of the primary. Reese had a hard edge, and so did some of his supporters. Their strategy was to paint me as a liberal, out-of-touch carpetbagger. They threw out all kinds of conspiracy theories. Dad was part of a trilateral commission campaign to establish a one-world government. I had been sent by the Rockefeller family to buy up farmland. 4 days before the election, Reese produced a copy of my birth certificate to prove I had been born back east. How was I supposed to counter that? I responded with a line Dad had once used. No, I wasn't born in Texas, because I wanted to be close to my mother that day. Reese received an endorsement and campaign contributions from Ronald Reagan, who was seeking an edge on Dad in the 1980 presidential primary. Despite all the innuendos, I was optimistic about my chances. My strategy was to build up a bulkhead in my home county of Midland. Laura and I attended coffees across town, organized the county block by block, and persuaded friends who had never been involved in politics to help us. Don Evans was the campaign chairman. Joe O'Neill was the treasurer. Robert McCleskey handled the accounting. On election night, our grassroots effort in Midland produced a massive turnout. I lost every other county in the district, but took Midland by such a huge margin that I won the nomination. Dad had predicted that Reagan would call to congratulate me if I won the primary. He did the next day. He was gracious and volunteered to help in the general election. I was grateful for his call and bore no hard feelings, but I was determined to run the race as my own man. I didn't do any campaigning with Reagan, nor did I do any with Dad. The race against Reese toughened me as a candidate. I learned I could take a hard punch, keep fighting, and win. My opponent in the general was Kent Hance, the state senator Governor Shivers had warned me about. Hance's strategy was the same as Reese's, turn me into an East Coast outsider. But he executed it with more subtlety and charm. One of my first TV ads showed me jogging, which I thought emphasized my energy and youth. Hance turned it against me with one line. The only time folks around here go running is when somebody's chasing them. He also ran a radio ad. In 1961, when Kent Hance graduated from Dimmitt High School in the 19th Congressional District, his opponent, George W. Bush, was attending Andover Academy in Massachusetts. In 1965, when Kent Hance graduated from Texas Tech, his opponent was at Yale University. And while Kent Hance graduated from University of Texas Law School, his opponent, get this folks, was attending Harvard. We don't need someone from the Northeast telling us what our problems are. Hance was a great storyteller, and he used his skill to pound away with the outsider theme. His favorite story was about a man in a limo who pulled up to a farm where Hance was working. When the driver asked him for directions to the next town, Hance said, "Turn right, just past the cattle guard, then follow the road." The punchline came when the driver asked, "Excuse me, but what color uniform will that cattle guard be wearing?" The West Texas crowds loved it. Hance would twist the knife by adding, "I couldn't tell if the limo had Massachusetts or Connecticut license plates." Laura and I moved temporarily to Lubbock, the biggest city in the district, about 115 miles north of Midland. An important hub for the cotton business, Lubbock was home to Texas Tech University. We used the city as our base to campaign in the district's rural counties. Laura and I spent hours in the car together, stumping in towns like Levelland, Plainview, and Brownfield. For someone who didn't particularly care for politics, Laura was a natural campaigner. Her genuineness made it easy for voters to relate to her. After our wedding, we had taken a short trip to Cozumel, Mexico, but we joked that the campaign was our honeymoon. On the 4th of July, we campaigned in Muleshoe, in the far northern part of the district. In the May primary, I had received 6 of the 230 votes cast in Bailey County. The way I saw it, I had plenty of room for improvement. Laura and I smiled and waved at the spectators from the back of our white pickup truck. Nobody cheered. Nobody even waved. People looked at us like we were aliens. By the end, I was convinced the only supporter I had in Muleshoe was the one sitting next to me. Election night came, and it turned out that old Governor Shivers was right. I won big in Midland County and in the southern part of the district, but not by enough to offset Hance's margins in Lubbock and elsewhere. The final tally was 53% to 47%. I hated losing, but I was glad I'd run. I enjoyed the hard work of politics, meeting people and making my case. I learned that allowing your opponent to define you is one of the biggest mistakes you can make in a campaign. And I discovered that I could accept defeat and move on. That was not easy for someone as competitive as I am, but it was an important part of my maturing. As for Congressman Kent Hance, he deserved to win that race, and we became good friends. 2 gubernatorial and presidential victories later, he is still the only politician ever to beat me. He went on to serve 3 terms in the House before losing a bid for the Senate. Then he became a Republican and contributed to my campaigns. Kent is now the Chancellor of Texas Tech. He says that without him, I would never have become president. He's probably right. 6 months after my campaign ended, I had another race to think about. Dad announced his candidacy for the 1980 presidential election. He was a long shot against Ronald Reagan, but he ran a strong campaign in Iowa and won an upset victory in the caucus. Unfortunately, his hot streak ran out amid the cold winters of New Hampshire. Reagan defeated him there and continued on to the Republican nomination. There was a lot of speculation about whom Reagan would choose for vice president. At the convention in Detroit, he was in discussions with Gerald Ford about some sort of co-presidency. They agreed it wouldn't work, a good decision. Then Reagan called Dad and asked him to be his running mate, an even better decision. On election night, the Reagan-Bush ticket crushed Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale 489-49 in the Electoral College. Laura and I flew to Washington for the inauguration on January 20, 1981. The first time the ceremony was held on the majestic west front of the Capitol. We beamed as Justice Potter Stewart swore in Dad. Then Ronald Reagan repeated the oath administered by Chief Justice Warren Burger. As a history major, I was thrilled to have a front row seat. As a son, I was filled with pride. It never crossed my mind that I would one day stand on that platform and hold up my right hand at two presidential inaugurations. The early 1980s brought tough moments, from a painful recession to the bombing of our Marine barracks in Lebanon. But the Reagan-Bush administration accomplished what it had promised. They cut taxes, regained the edge in the Cold War, and restored American morale. When President Reagan and Dad put their record before the voters in 1984, they won 49 of 50 states. Dad was the logical favorite for the 1988 presidential nomination, but the race would not be easy. He had been so loyal to President Reagan that he had done almost nothing to promote himself. He was also battling the infamous Van Buren factor. Not since Martin Van Buren followed Andrew Jackson into the White House in 1836 had a vice president been elected to succeed the president with whom he had served. Early in his second term, President Reagan generously allowed Dad to use the presidential retreat at Camp David for a meeting with his campaign team. It was thoughtful of Dad to invite all his siblings and children. I enjoyed meeting his team, although I had some reservations. Dad's top strategist was a young guy named Lee Atwater, a fast-talking, guitar-playing South Carolinian. Lee was considered one of the country's hottest political consultants. No question he was smart. No doubt he had experience. I wanted to know if he was loyal. When Dad asked if any of the family members had questions, my hand went up. "Lee, how do we know we can trust you since your business partners are working for other candidates?" I asked. Jeb chimed in. "If someone throws a grenade at our dad, we expect you to jump on it." Our tone was tough, but it reflected our love of Dad and our expectations of his staff. An agenda that put the candidate first and personal ambition second. Lee said he had known Dad at the Republican National Committee, admired him a lot, and wanted him to win. He added that he was planning to sever his conflicting business connections. Yet it was obvious that our doubts had shaken him. Later in the day, he sought out Jeb and me. "If we were so worried," he asked, "why didn't one of us move to D.C., help in the campaign, and keep an eye on him and the staff?" The invitation intrigued me. The timing was right. After the downturn in the oil markets, my partners and I had merged our exploration company and found jobs for all the employees. Dad liked the idea, and Laura was willing to give it a try. At the campaign office in downtown Washington, I had no title. As Dad put it, I already had a good one, son. I focused on fundraising, traveling the country to deliver surrogate speeches, and boosting the morale of volunteers by thanking them on Dad's behalf. From time to time, I also reminded some high-level staffers that they were on a team to advance George Bush's election, not their own careers. I learned a valuable lesson about Washington. Proximity to power is empowerment. Having Dad's ear made me effective. One of my tasks was to sort through journalists' requests for profile pieces. When Margaret Warner of Newsweek told us she wanted to do an interview, I recommended that we cooperate. Margaret was talented and seemed willing to write a fair piece. Dad agreed. Mother called me the morning the magazine hit the newsstand. Have you seen Newsweek? Not yet, I told her. They called your father a wimp, she growled. I quickly tracked down a copy and was greeted by the screaming headline, Fighting the Wimp Factor. I couldn't believe it. The magazine was insinuating that my father, a World War II bomber pilot, was a wimp. I was red hot. I got Margaret on the phone. She politely asked what I thought of the story. I impolitely told her I thought she was part of a political ambush. She muttered something about her editors being responsible for the cover. I did not mutter. I railed about editors and hung up. From then on, I was suspicious of political journalists and their unseen editors. After finishing third in Iowa, Dad rallied with a victory in New Hampshire and went on to earn the nomination. His opponent in the general election was the liberal governor of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis. Dad started the campaign with a great speech at the convention in New Orleans. I was amazed at the power of his words, elegantly written and forcefully delivered. He spoke of a kinder, gentler nation, built by the compassion and generosity of the American people, what he called a thousand points of light. He outlined a strong policy agenda, including a bold pledge. Read my lips. No new taxes. I was impressed with Dad's sense of timing. He had managed to navigate perfectly the transition from loyal vice president to candidate. He left the convention leading the polls and charged down the home stretch. On November 8, 1988, the family watched the returns at our friend Dr. Charles Neblett's house in Houston. I knew Dad had won when Ohio and New Jersey, two critical states, broke his way. By the end of the night, he had carried 40 states and 426 electoral votes. George H.W. Bush, the man I admired and adored, was elected the 41st president of the United States. Laura and I enjoyed our year and a half in Washington. But when people suggested that I stay in Washington and leverage my contacts, I never considered it. I had zero interest in being a lobbyist or hanger-on in Dad's administration. Not long after the election, we packed up for the trip back to Texas. I had another reason for moving home. Near the end of Dad's campaign, I received an intriguing phone call from my former business partner, Bill DeWitt. Bill's father had owned the Cincinnati Reds and was well-connected in the baseball community. He had heard that Eddie Childs, the principal owner of the Texas Rangers, was looking to sell the team. Would I be interested in buying? I almost jumped out of my chair. Owning a baseball team would be a dream come true. I was determined to make it happen. My strategy was to make myself the buyer of choice. Laura and I moved to Dallas, and I visited Eddie and his wife, Fran, frequently. I promised to be a good steward of the franchise he loved. He said, "You've got a great name and a lot of potential. I'd love to sell to you, son, but you don't have any money." I went to work lining up potential investors, mostly friends across the country. When Commissioner Peter Uberoth argued that we needed more local owners, I went to see a highly successful Fort Worth investor, Richard Rainwater. I had courted Richard before, and he had turned me down. This time he was receptive. Richard agreed to raise half the money for the franchise so long as I raised the other half and agreed to make his friend Rusty Rose co-managing partner. I went to meet Rusty at Brook Hollow Golf Club in Dallas. He seemed like a shy guy. He had never followed baseball, but he was great with finances. We talked about him being the inside guy who dealt with the numbers, and me being the outside guy who dealt with the public. Shortly thereafter, Laura and I were at a black tie charity function. Our plans for the team had leaked out, and a casual acquaintance pulled me aside and whispered, "Do you know that Rusty Rose is crazy? You'd better watch out." At first, I blew this off as mindless chatter. Then I fretted. What did crazy mean? I called Richard and told him what I had heard. He suggested that I ask Rusty myself. That would be a little awkward. I barely knew the guy, and I was supposed to question his mental stability? I saw Rusty at a meeting that afternoon. As soon as I entered the conference room, he walked over to me and said, "I understand you have a problem with my mental state. I see a shrink. I have been sick. What of it?" It turned out Rusty was not crazy. This was his awkward way of laying out the truth, which was that he suffered from a chemical imbalance that, if not properly treated, could drive his bright mind toward anxiety. I felt so small, I apologized. Rusty and I went on to build a great friendship. He helped me to understand how depression, an illness I later learned had also afflicted Mother for a time in her life, could be managed with proper care. 2 decades later, in the Oval Office, I stood with Senators Pete Domenici and Ted Kennedy and signed a bill mandating that insurance companies cover treatment for patients with mental illness. As I did, I thought of my friend, Rusty Rose. With Rusty and Richard as part of our ownership group, we were approved to buy the team. I am particularly grateful to Commissioner Peter Uberoff, American League President Bobby Brown, and Jerry Reinsdorf of the Chicago White Sox for their help in navigating the buying process. Eddie Chiles suggested that he introduce us to the fans as the new owners on opening day 1989. We walked out of the dugout, across the lush green grass and onto the pitcher's mound, where we joined Eddie and legendary Dallas Cowboys coach Tom Landry, who threw out the first pitch. I turned to Rusty and said, "This is as good as it gets." Over the next 5 seasons, Laura and I went to 50 or 60 ball games a year. We saw a lot of wins, endured our fair share of losses, and enjoyed countless hours side by side. We took the girls to spring training and brought them to the park as much as possible. I traveled throughout the Rangers market, delivering speeches to sell tickets and talking up the ball club with local media. Over time, I grew more comfortable behind the lectern. I learned how to connect with the crowd and convey a clear message. I also gained valuable experience handling tough questions from journalists, in this case, mostly about our shaky pitching rotation. Running the Rangers sharpened my management skills. Rusty and I spent our time on the major financial and strategic issues and left the baseball decisions to baseball men. When people did not perform, we made changes. It wasn't easy to ask decent folks like Bobby Valentine, a dynamic manager who had become a friend of mine, to move on. But I tried to deliver the news in a thoughtful way, and Bobby handled it like a professional. I was grateful when years later I heard him say, "I voted for George W. Bush, even though he fired me." When Rusty and I took over, the Rangers had finished with a losing record 7 of the previous 9 years. The club posted a winning record 4 of our first 5 seasons. The improvements on the field brought more people to the stands. Still, the economics of baseball were tough for a small market team. We never asked the ownership group for more capital, but we never distributed cash either. Rusty and I realized the best way to increase the long-term value of the franchise was to upgrade our stadium. The Rangers were a major league team playing in a minor league ballpark. We designed a public-private financing system to fund the construction of a new stadium. I had no objection to a temporary sales tax increase to pay for the park, so long as local citizens had a chance to vote on it. They passed it by a margin of nearly 2-1. Thanks to the leadership of Tom Schieffer, a former Democratic state representative who did such a fine job overseeing the stadium project that I later asked him to serve as ambassador to Australia and Japan,